From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde. If you're addicted to potato chips, or perhaps cheese, our guest today says that's no accident. Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. In 2010, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his investigation of the dangers of contaminated meat. His new book explores how the food industry carefully crafts products to hook humans as if they were lab rats. And Moss says that the food giants did this even when CEOs knew that they were creating an obesity epidemic. The book's called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael Moss, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So before we get into the book, I want to ask a little bit about you. You've actually worked as a war correspondent, and I'm wondering how you made the transition to getting interested in food.
I was in Algeria in 2008 interviewing militant jihadists there when two FBI agents showed up at the New York Times headquarters looking for me. They said I had managed to land on an Al-Qaeda hit list, and the newspaper's editor, Bill Keller, ordered me home. Later that same year, my editor, Christine Kay, and I were eating in the New York Times lunch cafeteria up on the 14th floor, and she said to me one word, peanuts. A factory in southern Georgia had allowed its peanuts to become contaminated by salmonella. 8 people died. An estimated 19,000 were sick and across the country. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized this was an issue of sort of the industry losing control over its ingredients. And I then segued to reporting on hamburger, which you mentioned, which was another issue of the industry losing control over its supplies. But I was reporting on more contamination when one of my most trusted sources in the processed food industry said to me, you know, Michael, as much as these incidents are tragic and important, there's another public health crisis afoot caused by things we're intentionally adding to products over which we have absolute total control. And, you know, 3 years, that was the start of my book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. And 3 years, I'm here to say he was so right. The obesity crisis, et cetera, the numbers are just startling.
Michael Moss is with us. His new book is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. The book starts with this kind of amazing meeting between the food giants back in 1999.
Yeah.
It's Nabisco, it's General Mills, yeah. It's Kraft. Yeah. It's like you're walking down the aisle of your grocery store. And I'm wondering, why did all these food giants get together for a meeting like that?
For me, this book was such a detective story. And early on in my reporting, I came across the documents that referred to this meeting, and then I interviewed people who were present. They were brought together by a cobble of insiders who were growing increasingly concerned about the emerging obesity issue. This was back in 1999. And none other than one of their own, a senior executive at Kraft named Michael Mudd, got up before these CEOs armed with 114 slides, and he went through them laying the obesity crisis at their feet, linking their products to obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, even some cancers. And he said, look, even if you don't accept responsibility for all of this, the lawyers who went after the tobacco industry will be coming after you inevitably. And he pleaded with them to collectively do something to turn the corner on the behalf of consumers.
How did they respond?
From his perspective, the meeting was an utter failure. They responded defensively. They said, look, we've already got low-fat, low-sugar items on the store. We've got, you know, whatever people want. We offer a choice. We do care about nutrition. But, you know, to remind you, we also have an obligation to shareholders, and there is Wall Street looking at us. And at this point, we think this whole concern about obesity is a bit overblown.
Why weren't they more worried about legal action, about getting sued?
They're actually, to this day, still confident that they could resist a legal onslaught of the type that went after the tobacco industry. Because, look, I mean, there's something inherently different about food and tobacco. And the problem with the processed food industry is that, you know, they didn't intend to make us obese, and none of their products individually can be blamed for the epidemic. It's their collective zeal to do what companies do, which is to make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible. That's where the problem lies.
You're an investigative journalist, but how did you get your hands on this information?
Oddly enough, one of the greatest troves of documents that I came across was collected none other than by the litigation that the state attorneys general brought against the tobacco industry. Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company in the world, had become the largest food manufacturer in North America by acquiring the old General Foods and then Kraft. It kept a low profile, but in these documents were some amazing strategy papers, planning memos, plotting, scheming by the food division of Philip Morris interacting with the tobacco officials. And that was, they were so powerful that they helped me convince key officials inside companies to open up and reveal even more secrets.
Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and his new book looks at how the food giants hooked Americans on sugar, salt, and fat. And I want to ask about sugar. There's some amazing stories here. One of the ones that I really liked reading about was Dr. Pepper. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sugars, you know, maybe perhaps the most powerful of the three. We are hardwired for sugar. Every one of our 10,000 taste buds is linked to the pleasure center of the brain. And the second sugar hits us, it races to the brain and says, eat more. I love these calories. A legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz, who was trained at Harvard and helped engineer, in his words, some of the most iconic products in the supermarket, was asked by Dr. Pepper to come up with a new soda flavor a few years ago. And to do so, he devised or looked at 61 different flavorings, sweet flavorings, each just slightly different than the other one, submitted those to more than 3,000 consumer taste tests, took all the data and threw it in his computer and did his high math regression analysis thing to come up with the precise amount of sugar that would send us over the moon and guarantee that the soda would be a precise hit. He describes it to me as a bell-shaped curve, and your listeners can do this experiment themselves if they like sugar in their coffee. Just keep adding sugar to get to the place where you like it the most. Keep adding more, and eventually you'll go, yuck, this is too sweet. Well, the very optimum amount of sugar is known as the bliss point, and there are bliss points by the industry design for everything in the supermarket that has a sweet taste to it, not just soda.
I can imagine somebody out there listening and saying to themselves, you know, I love Dr. Pepper. Bliss point. It sounds good.
Yeah.
But you've got a different perspective. What is it?
Well, the really driving force of the industry is not, you know, how do we get people to like our product? Is how do we get people to drink or eat more and more? Because, again, you have to understand these are companies driven to maintain revenue, increase profits. And that's one of the difficult things for so many people is that when they reach the bliss point, or for fat, it's known as the mouthfeel, or for salt, they call it the flavor burst. When they hit these things perfectly, their products become craveable, snackable, irresistible, and yeah, even take on the A word, a bit of addictiveness.
You actually bring up all of those different adjectives and in your discussion about whether or not these products are actually addictive.
Right.
What are the food companies, or what are some of those words, and what do the food companies think about whether or not they're actually creating addicts?
There's no word they hate more than the word addictive, and they have euphemisms for it. Again, snackable, alluring, craveable, even though like. And I'm sympathetic, but I did spend time with Nora Volkow at the National Institutes on Drug Abuse. She's a scientist as well, and she has done neurological studies looking at how the brain responds to both narcotics and highly sweet, palatable, highly fat foods. And she's concluded that for some people, some of us, which means many, many people, the most highly palatable, highly processed foods are every bit as addictive as some narcotics. And even more than that, it's in her eyes even more difficult to deal with, to resist sort of over-consuming food, because you can't just go cold turkey on food like you can on narcotics. It's everywhere, and you're hit by the marketing and the advertising, as well as the formulation everywhere you go.
The book is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and the author is Michael Moss. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. We talked about sugar. I want to hear a little bit more about fat. What are some of the things that food scientists have discovered about fat and our relationship to fat?
There's no basic taste for fat like there is sugar and salt. So what there is a feeling, and thus their term for the allure of fat is mouthfeel. It's that warm, gooey sensation you get when you bite into a toasted cheese sandwich, and you can tell I'm a cheese lover, that, again, races to the pleasure center of the brain just like sugar. In some ways, fat is even more powerful than sugar than for the industry, because there is no maximum bliss point for fat. Or if there is, it's way up in the land of heavy cream. And the industry has also discovered if you add a bit of sugar to the fat, the brain is actually less apt to recognize the fat intake and to send, you know, to hit the brakes and send you that message saying, hey, you better slow down on this, Michael, because, by the way, fat has twice as many calories as sugar does.
And you also write about the combination of fat and sugar and how that works on the brain when you eat, you know, fat-rich ice cream, for example. How does it work?
Yeah, when you introduce sugar with the fat, it tricks the brain into thinking that you're actually using less. And the appeal just kind of goes up. And the industry knows that. And one of the amazing things is sort of when they do combinations in foods and they look at the combination of sugar, fat, and salt all working together in some foods. And there are some where you don't even actually realize that you're getting all three ingredients. I love to talk about potato chips, one of my favorite snackables, and certainly was when I was writing the book. We all know that they have salt, and that hits you immediately as you put the chip in your mouth. We all know that they're soaked in fat, and that gives that wonderful sort of mouthfeel. But what I didn't know is that potato chips are also loaded with sugar, and it's not added sugar. It's sugar in the form of the potato starch, which immediately starts getting converted to sugar in your body the second it hits the tongue. And so you've got all three, you know, the holy grail of the processed food industry, sugar, fat, and salt working on your brain, compelling it to eat.
Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. If I offer you potato chips after this interview, would you take them?
Oh, absolutely. I love potato chips. There are some that are too salty, and lately I've been looking for those with less salt because I find those actually just as appealing. And that's one of the really interesting things about salt, because when I get to that in the book, what really astounds me about that is the industry's own dependence on salt as a miracle ingredient. And let me just back up a second. It turns out we're not born loving salt like we are sugar and fat. That begins at about age 6 months. And if you think about it, it's because sodium, which is the bad boy of salt that's linked to high blood pressure, you really need very, very little of that to survive. And recent research has shown that the processed food industry is very influential in shaping our craving for salt. Studies have been done on kids, and those who are exposed most to highly processed foods starting at age 6 months were more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in preschool. And I know that well because one of my boys did it did that very same thing. But you can get off of salt really easily. Anybody who's been on a low sodium diet under doctor's orders knows that just after maybe 6 weeks, you can hardly go into the grocery store and find something that's not appallingly salty. Well, that said, the food industry itself is totally hooked on salt as a miracle ingredient because A, it acts as a preservative, so they get that long-lasting shelf life, which is essential to the ultra-processed foods. B, it allows them to avoid using more costly ingredients in food. Salt is really cheap, 10 cents a pound. They can avoid using fresh herbs and spices just by adding in more salt for flavor. And C, it masks some of the awful off notes that are inherent to some processed foods. One of the biggest ones is meat. When meat gets reheated in your home by buying a product with meat in it, the fat oxidizes and gives off something called warmed over flavor, which food scientists describe as tasting like wet dog hair. And the cure to the wet dog hair taste is to add some more salt to the product.
So in the case of salt, are the food giants conspiring to addict us to this stuff? Is this the kind of clear-cut example where that you think is actually going on?
I spent time, one of my favorite people I spent time with was a former president of North America, Latin America for Coca-Cola. He was one of their fiercest warriors named Jeffrey Dunn. He walked me through their targeting of teens, their pioneering of the supersize me phenomena, their description of their best customers as heavy users. And when I caught up with him recently, he left the company after 20 years, I caught up with him and he's now selling fresh carrots for what he calls doing his karmic debt to his 2 decades at Coca-Cola. But he said to me, you know, Michael, there really is no smoking gun here. The gun is right on the table. It's not hiding. That's the genius of Coke. And if you think about the processed food industry, there's so many examples like that. Like, think about that fabulous slogan that Madison Avenue came up with for Frito-Lay decades ago that just dared us to challenge the obvious in some of these foods. Remember it, bet you can't eat just one. So for me, the potato chips is such a great example. So it's not like there's a conspiracy on their part, because a lot of these companies don't like each other. They're fighting each other for space on the shelf vehemently. So again, the issue here is their collective zeal to do what these companies do, which is make more money, sell more product.
And since you mentioned slogans, you know, what role do you think advertising is playing here in comparison to all this amazing food science that's hooking us kind of biologically? What role is the message playing?
It's huge. I met the inventor of the Lunchables, the cold dinner TV-like tray of foods for kids. He walked me through the invention process, which took several years, and it has a wonderful story, because Oscar Mayer which owned the Lunchables in the beginning and then morphed into Kraft. When it was having some trouble with its red meat, people were eating less red meat because of the high saturated fat and salt content. One of their solutions was to repackage their meats along with cheese and crackers into these little trays called the Lunchables. But at some point, Kraft realized the Lunchables really weren't about the food as much as they were about the empowerment. And they came up with the slogan for kids: all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. And this really became evident to them how huge the marketing power of Lunchable was when they invented the pizza Lunchable, which is just a cold piece of dough crust with a little bit of pizza sauce and cheese that the kids assemble themselves. When they asked the moms about it, they said, there's no way my kid's going to eat this. And they gave it to the kids and they said, oh, this is great. I can make it myself in the cafeteria. I'm going to have like star power. And so there's, you know, a near $1 billion a year item that's almost entirely owes its popularity to the marketing and the advertising.
New York Times investigative reporter Michael Moss is telling us about how the food giants hooked us on salt, sugar, and fat. Michael, I want to ask about sort of policy and politics and personal responsibility at the end, because these books kind of come down to solutions, it seems like.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people looking at this would say, you know, a big part of the obesity crisis just boils down to personal responsibility, personal choices, and sort of bad decision-making of something we haven't talked about, which is sort of exercise. Where do you come down?
You know, hats off to Michelle Obama for pushing the Let's Move campaign, and certainly exercise is sort of part of the equation. But I happen to know that the White House is also looking really closely at other ways to level the playing field, because one of the big issues here is that when you walk in the door of the grocery store, it's stacked against you. So in talking about how to sort of get out of this situation, I've, you know, in my own life with my two kids and my wife, we've been dealing with things like, look, make a list and try to stick with it, because the companies do everything they can to get you to make a spontaneous decision, like putting the soda cooler at the checkout counter. Work the margins of the grocery store where the fruits and vegetables are. Everybody tells us we should be eating more of those, but it's so compelling, and you're actually lured into the center of the grocery store where the highly processed foods are. And it's, as I mentioned, in the cereal aisle, you know, look high and look low for those less sugary cereals, because they are there if you know how to look for them. And of course, and also pay attention to both the back of the label where the nutrition facts are. But I also like to say, start with the front, because that's kind of where the touts are and the come-ons, like the low-fat yogurt, which can have as much sugar in it per serving as ice cream.
You know, I don't want to make too many assumptions about KUOW listeners or people that are going to, you know, attend your talk tonight or read your book. But what about people who aren't going to get that message and really aren't hearing it at all, maybe don't have the means to hear these messages? Is there a class problem here that personal responsibility message really just doesn't get at.
Well, I think that's exactly what the mayor of New York is arguing with his attempt to control the huge size sodas that are available. It's exactly what I saw in a very poor neighborhood of Philadelphia that I spent some time in, where the school principal wanted to improve grades, noticed the kids were coming in strung out on junk food, unable to pay attention. She got parents to actually intervene and try to keep the corner stores from selling this stuff to kids in the morning before school. And here were these parents of very modest economic means standing on the corner trying to deflect their kids into the school and away from the corner stores. I was sort of hugely moved by that. So I think we're getting to a tipping point where consumers raising their voices and acting on their decisions is going to put pressure on these companies to do the right thing in meaningful ways.
But how can any of them act unilaterally? You bring this up in your book and actually de-escalate, yeah, you know, the salt, sugar, and fats.
Well, right. And that is the problem. Back in 1999, that's why Michael Mudd was asking for collective action, because Kraft, in fact, went ahead and tried to do some obesity initiatives, and hats off to them, too, for making valid attempts, but they faced increasing pressure from competitors. I was really struck by an interview I had with the former CEO, Philip Morris, who said to me, look, Michael, I am no fan of government regulation, but what you're looking at here in the food industry, this may be the time to actually accept that, because government regulation would give the food companies cover from Wall Street, because every time one of them tries to do the right thing, Wall Street investors, analysts are there breathing down their neck. It happened recently with Campbell's Soup. Tried to cut back in salt, and just a tiny line of its soups, Wall Street just coughed and they put the salt back in.
Michael Moss, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Check out his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. From KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde.